Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the head of the FCC has just announced new rules protecting the openness of the internet. The vote is still weeks away, but if agency chair Tom Wheeler's proposal goes through, it would mean real net neutrality, maintaining the even playing field that makes the internet what it is. And it would be a landmark victory for regular folks over industry titans. We'll talk about what it all means with Craig Aaron of the group Free Press. Also on the show, it's safe to say that many people know the names Michael Brown and Eric Garner, and they should. It's also safe to say fewer know Ayanna Stanley Jones, a 7-year-old killed by police in Detroit, or Yvette Smith, killed in Texas, Katherine Johnson, Gabriela Nevarez. I could sadly go on and on. Black women and children are killed by law enforcement, too. So why is it that when we talk about state-sanctioned violence, black victim seems to mean black male? We'll talk about that in the effort to change it with law professor Kimberly Crenshaw, lead author of the new report, Black Girls Matter. That's coming up, but first, as usual, I'll take a quick look back at the week's press. NBC Nightly News anchor Brian Williams apologized recently for falsely claiming that during the invasion of Iraq, the helicopter he was traveling in was forced down after being hit by an RPG. Quote, "I made a mistake in recalling the events of 12 years ago," close quote. That's what Williams told his audience on February 4th. Quote, "I don't know what screwed up in my mind that caused me to conflate one aircraft with another," close quote. Now that he's cleared that up, there are some other tall tales that Williams might want to take back. For example, his recounting of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, in which he claimed, quote, "You know, I've been around a lot of guns and a lot of dead bodies and a lot of people shooting at people to make dead bodies. But you put them all together and you put it in the United States of America, and boy, it gets your attention," close quote. Williams said that because he and his crew were bathed in light, they were a target. Quote, "We had to ask Federal Protection Service guys with automatic weapons to just form a ring and watch our backs while we were doing Dateline NBC one night. State troopers had to cover us by aiming at the men in the street just to tell them, don't think of doing a smash and grab and killing this guy for the car," close quote. So, while he's feeling confessional, Williams might as well admit that he did not see a lot of people shooting at people to make dead bodies, nor would people have killed him for his car if he hadn't been surrounded by feds, neither of which claims appeared in his original reporting. The New York Times cited a state medical official's tally that 6 or 7 deaths appear to have been the result of homicides in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Indeed, as the New Orleans Times-Picayune put it in a Pulitzer Prize-winning story, after the fog cleared, quote, "The vast majority of reported atrocities committed by evacuees have turned out to be false, or at least unsupported by any evidence, according to key military, law enforcement, medical, and civilian officials in positions to know," close quote. It'd be great if Williams wanted to clear that one up as well. McClatchy's Kevin Hall had some conventional wisdom to drop February 2nd. Quote, "Few things defy gravity more than federal spending. In the nation's capital, what goes up does not come down. It goes up more," close quote. Well, sort of. The U.S. population grows every year, and its economy grows on top of that most years, so it would be surprising if the real expenditures of the U.S. government didn't generally get bigger and not smaller over time. A more reasonable indicator might be federal spending as a percentage of the U.S. economy, and that, contrary to Hall's lead, does go up and down. It was 22.3% of GDP in 1982 and 17.4% in 2000. At the height of World War II, the last time the U.S. faced a serious military threat, federal spending topped out at 40.7% of GDP. It's true that the proportion of the U.S. economy devoted to federal spending increased markedly as Washington took on responsibility for ensuring retirement, that's Social Security, and health care for the elderly, or Medicare. These programs are very popular because they're very successful at doing what they're intended to do, which is reducing the chances that our grandparents, our parents, and finally ourselves will end our lives in poverty, sickness, and misery. Some would see this as a good thing, but not Hall. He quotes austerity advocate Rudolf Penner's statement that about half our spending these days is going to Social Security and various health programs, and most of these are extraordinarily popular politically. And then he adds in his own voice, quote, "Therein rests the problem with federal spending. It's hard to cut programs that have a constituency with a vested interest," close quote. Well, yes. And it's not that the country can't afford to keep supporting its elderly in the not particularly generous manner that it does today. Hall throws out some big debt projection numbers that shrink on examination. Obama's budget plan would move the federal government's share of the economy from 20.9% today to 22.2% in 2024, a trivial redistribution of what is expected to be a much larger economic pie. But then redistributing that pie would mean taking back a small fraction of the enormous gains that the very wealthy have made over the past 40 years. And if there's one thing that journalists, whose job it is to explain the economy to the rest of us, are paid to understand, it's that the rich getting richer is meant to be a one-way street. Finally, some recent headlines. U.S. nuclear scientist who offered to help Venezuela build nuclear bombs gets 60 months. That's the Washington Post on January 29th. Or the previous day's Minneapolis Star Tribune. Ex-Los Alamos scientist accused of offering to make Venezuela a nuclear weapon to be sentenced. At NBC News, it was ex-Los Alamos scientist gets 5 years in Venezuelan nuclear bomb plot. And CBS's New York affiliate made it local with ex-Los Alamos scientist heard offering to design bomb directed at NYC for Venezuela. What you'd never guess from all of this is that there was no Venezuelan nuclear bomb plot, and the scientist in question, Pedro Leonardo Mascheroni, didn't offer Venezuela anything. What Mascheroni was convicted of was telling undercover FBI agents who were pretending to work for Venezuela that he could give them nuclear weapons secrets. In real life, Venezuela had nothing to do with it. The distinction is critical because accurate headlines wouldn't leave casual readers with the impression that Venezuela was interested in getting a nuclear bomb or in trying to nuke New York. From the point of view of the U.S. government, though, that misimpression is no doubt a feature and not a bug. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. FCC Chair Tom Wheeler has just announced what he called the strongest open internet protections ever proposed by the agency. The rules, Wheeler explained, will assure the rights of internet users to go where they want, when they want, and the rights of innovators to introduce new products without asking anyone's permission. You can be forgiven for not quite believing it, given the FCC's historical record as handmaiden to corporate media companies, but it looks as though this time the agency entrusted with looking out for the public interest in communications is looking out for the public interest. So how is Wheeler's proposal different from what's come before? How did we get here? And how can we expect it to play out? Here to talk about the meaning of the decision is Craig Aaron. He's president of the group Free Press. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Craig Aaron.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, the FCC has claimed to be protecting the openness, the even playing field of the internet for some years now, after many years of not even giving lip service to that idea. But this is different in a big way. What is the substance, then, of the proposal that FCC Chair Tom Wheeler has just announced?
Yeah, I'm still pinching myself, but this is the real thing, real net neutrality, the key element in what the FCC is proposing finally after years and years of advocacy, is doing what's called reclassifying broadband under Title II of the Communications Act. And that's sort of the wonky legal way to talk about the FCC having the authority to protect internet users and actually be able to step in when a big phone or cable company abuses their near monopoly power. There's 3 weeks until a final vote, so we're going to have to stay vigilant, make sure this doesn't get watered down. But what they're proposing to do right now looks very good.
So what is Title II? What is this reclassification from what to what?
Title II is a part of the Communications Act, the laws that govern all of our communications networks. And sort of the whole problem we've had with the FCC that created this net neutrality issue was that back during the Bush administration, they changed how broadband was treated under the law. So instead of treating it as part of what's called Title II, which just means you treat it as a telecommunications service or a two-way communication service, services like the phone that allow me to talk to you and you to talk to me, they treated it more like an information service, which was a set of regulations that applied to things like websites or the LexisNexis searches and things like that. So we had a problem where in an effort to deregulate and really to keep the cable industry from having to share its lines, the FCC sort of threw out the baby with the bathwater and created this big mess around net neutrality. The important thing they're poised to do right now is fix that original problem and actually make sure that the important principles that have always been part of our communication system, always been a part of two-way communications networks, actually carry forward into the internet age.
Well, the argument against reclassification, the industry argument, has been that it would discourage investment. Wheeler seems to be saying that that's just not going to hold water.
Yeah, I think that in the process of this fight, he's realized that those claims are really garbage. And the strongest evidence of that is that when these companies, when they're in Washington, D.C., they love to go and talk to policymakers about how any kind of regulations or responsibilities are going to lead to diminishing investment, you know, even as they're raking in 90% profit margins on cable modems and things like that. But the fact is, when these same companies actually go to Wall Street and actually talk to investors, they're very clear and legally obligated to acknowledge that there is no real anticipated impact on investment. And if anything, having an actual even playing field online is going to benefit the larger economy and obviously certainly our larger democracy and social benefit of having a lot of competing voices and not just whatever Comcast or AT&T decides you should be able to see or watch.
Well, one often overlooked aspect of this is that there have been different rules for mobile broadband, and that happens to be where a great number of people of color in particular access the internet as opposed to home computers. So applying the rules to mobile broadband is also huge, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is a big deal because in the last time the FCC did this in 2010, they did allow a different set of rules for mobile, really allowing a lot more discrimination on, you know, emerging technologies. And, you know, as we all know, there's one internet. Whether you're getting to it from your phone, whether you're getting to it from a home connection, you want the same kind of information, the same kind of choices. And, you know, barring, you know, really obvious engineering limitations, these companies shouldn't be able to interfere just to promote their own services just because, you know, one kind of company wants to cut a deal with them. You know, basically, the model they've been operating from is one of artificial scarcity. That's what they like, where they can slow everybody down so that there's a reason people would pay for these faster speeds. The fact is, there's plenty of capacity for what we want to do, and the incentives we want to exist are for these companies to actually just invest in making the pipes bigger, not in picking and choosing winners and losers. We don't need them to do that for us.
Well, it was not long ago that media activism didn't really engage the FCC. They were so thoroughly understood to be enablers of corporate owners. Former FCC Chair Michael Powell once said he had no idea what the public interest is. And he argued that the laissez-faire approach should be beyond challenge because, as he put it, we won the Cold War. He famously joked about the digital divide. You know, I think there's a Mercedes divide. I'd like to have one. I can't afford one. Basically, a straight-up defense of fast lanes and slow lanes because market, you know. So this is really just a big old victory for activists, isn't it? It's not what was going to happen anyway.
The activism has made all the difference. I mean, we can all be happy that Michael Powell has managed to close the Mercedes divide because he left the FCC and now became the nation's top cable industry lobbyist. And you're right, that's the kind of FCC we're dealing with. I mean, even the current chairman, Tom Wheeler, who is making a bold step forward with this action, he used to be the nation's top cable lobbyist, 15, 20 years ago. So we have this incredible revolving door, a really co-opted and frankly corrupted agency. But what we've seen, because of the attention and activism on a place that wasn't used to it, it can really make a huge difference. We got to be vigilant over these last 3 weeks. The FCC has a long tradition of hiding things in the footnotes and watering things down at the last minute. But where things stand now, they're absolutely headed in the right direction.
And just finally, in terms of media coverage, when we read then that really this is the result of, you know, companies like Amazon and Google putting pressure on the FCC, they were really the ones who actually made it happen. That's just not true.
I mean, it really isn't. I've been as close to this fight as anybody. And, you know, there were companies that got involved in this fight, but they were startups like Etsy and Kickstarter, you know, small operations, really worried about what this could do to their business. The big guys who, frankly, could afford to buy their way around any problems, you know, they did maybe said a few positive things in the press here and there, but they were not actively advocating for this. This was absolutely a bottom-up grassroots effort and an unusual one that wasn't backed by corporate money. I know Free Press has been working on this for 10 years. We don't take any corporate dollars. It may in the end be good for those companies. I absolutely think it will be. But there was not a secret cabal led by Google here. In fact, if anything, at times a company like Google was something of a hindrance because they wouldn't speak up because they were so afraid of other things on their agenda and they didn't maybe want to rile up the Republicans or whatever their reasons were. But the idea that this was, you know, simply a clash of titans among business interests just simply isn't the story. There are some titans here, but their names are Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon, and they've met a grassroots army of opposition. And for this time, at least, that grassroots army seems to have really made the difference.
We've been speaking with Craig Aaron of Free Press. Find their work, including more on this important decision, at freepress.net. Craig Aaron, thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Black Lives Matter movement has put a spotlight on real-world racism in our supposedly post-racial society, and part of that is a challenge to corporate media's narrow and negative portrayals. But the face of black people in the conversation is overwhelmingly male. It might surprise some, therefore, to realize that the same phenomena that weigh on black men and boys, things like aggressive policing and the school-to-prison pipeline, also affect black women and girls, which makes it all the more significant that proposed policy responses, things like Barack Obama's My Brother's Keeper initiative, leave those women and girls out. A new report seeks to change that conversation. It's called Black Girls Matter: Pushed Out, Overpoliced, and Underprotected. Its lead author is Professor Kimberly Crenshaw. She's co-founder of the African American Policy Forum, on whose advisory board I serve, and director of the Center for Intersectionality and Social Policy Studies at Columbia Law School. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Kimberly Crenshaw.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
Well, what were some of the immediate spurs to produce this report? What's the contribution, or you might say intervention, that you're looking to achieve here?
Well, the report actually has somewhat of a long genealogy, and we're fortunate that it's come out at a time where its relevance seems perhaps even more obvious than when we started thinking about it. This was a topic that my co-authors and I were talking about 4 years ago when we tried to pull together a group of women, formerly incarcerated women, women who worked on behalf of women and girls who were involved in the criminal justice system, just to begin to articulate some of the challenges that face black women in particular and make them more vulnerable to incarceration. And we uncovered two things. One was that there were some risks that were similar and some that were distinct, and we needed to have a conversation about how black women were situated with respect to supervision, surveillance, and incarceration. But the second thing, and this was the most surprising thing, was even those women who had been formerly incarcerated or were working with women who were at risk felt that the conversation was in some ways a backdoor conversation, one that they weren't fully comfortable telling their colleagues that they were engaged in, one that might put them in the light of some of their allies in a negative light. And so it was clear to us that, number one, we needed to have more conversations, more research, more awareness, more policy intervention. But we also needed to do so in a way that allowed people to feel as though the conversation about women was perfectly legitimate within the parameters of how we think and talk about the overall agenda around racial justice. So we started with a conference on women, race, and criminalization. And out of that came the recognition that many of these patterns and pathways really began at school with institutional policies that either pushed girls out of school, made them marginal within school, or actually became the doorway from which they went directly into the juvenile justice system.
Well, I'm going to ask you about the content and some of the stories, but I just want to clarify, you're saying that some women said it was a conversation they didn't want to have, that it wouldn't be seen in a good light because it would be seen as because it's seen as less legitimate, it would be seen as a detraction from something else?
Yes. The primary concern around racism and criminalization is the way it impacts men and boys. The assumption was that we need to maintain a singular focus on men and boys, and that including women and girls would be seen as a distraction.
And that, of course, is all tied up in the problem itself. Well, how was the report produced? What were some of the specifics of the that women and girls told you about how they'd been impacted by?
Well, we looked at two things. We first looked at just what the picture was in terms of push out and discipline in schools, because much of the literature that had already been circulated about the relationship between push out and longer-term negative consequences had been focused on men and boys. So we wanted to know, do women and girls face similar kinds of push-out? Do they face similar kinds of disciplinary patterns? And what we found was not only did black girls face racial disparity in the visitation of disciplinary measures on them, but the disparity between the level of punishment that black girls face vis-a-vis white girls was actually several times greater than the disparity that black boys face versus white boys. So that was from data that took in numbers from across the country, but we also found in Boston and New York that the ratio was actually even higher than the overall national data. So that was an eye-opener for us right there.
And it's not to say, you know, black girls exist, and so whatever you do for black boys, you should do for them too, because there are, in fact, special gendered issues that are confronting black girls.
And this is what the focus group conversation allowed us to see. So we asked young women who had been separated from school, either because they dropped out, they were pushed out, they were suspended or expelled. And they told us that they faced some things that were same and some things that were different. Among the things that were the same was, you know, the zero tolerance policies, the consequence of, you know, having a conflict with a teacher might cause you to be suspended and eventually expelled. The overall environment in zero-tolerance schools, young women said, was just simply not conducive to learning. They got the clear message that they were there to be disciplined and to be put in order, you know, not necessarily to be taught. And then they told us that they were fully aware that the teachers actually saw them through a stereotypical frame. So they said the teachers didn't trust them. They thought that they were ignorant, defiant. One of the young women said, oh, yeah, they saw us as all ghetto. And most importantly, they felt that they were experiencing double standards. They thought that as girls, they were frequently more likely to be disciplined and sent to the principal's office for engaging in unladylike behavior. So if they got into an argument or a fight or the teacher saw their responses as being defiant, they were more likely to be punished for these things because they're not gender-appropriate behavior. So we saw that. We saw the impact of sexual harassment, and we saw the impact of actually having to take care of children and how that also caused detachment from school.
Well, one of the things that the activism-inspired reporting in the wake of Ferguson has pointed up is that we don't even know how many people are killed by law enforcement. There are holes in that data, and it seems relevant here, too. It's meaningful that it seems that there are some things we don't count or the data is not in circulation, and that kind of keeps us from seeing it.
You know, I call it just a cycle of invisibility because the framing of the problem as an exclusively male problem from the beginning creates reports and research strategies that exclude girls from the analysis. That in turn creates programs and interventions which exacerbate the exclusion of the girls and sometimes sends messages to girls that achievement in school is not particularly important for them. That in turn means that we don't really have enough interventions that we can scale up at a moment like this, even if it were the case that my brother's keeper had included girls and women. What we're trying to do with this kind of work is provide the information that's necessary not only to policymakers, but primarily to stakeholders, to family members, to community leaders. So number one, they know it's just not true that the girls are okay. The girls are not okay. The girls show they're not being okay in different ways, but they're not on the pathway to achievement in the numbers that they need to be. And these racial disparities ought to be as important to us as the importance of the disparities among our sons.
We've been speaking with Kimberly Crenshaw of the African American Policy Forum and the Center for Intersectionality and Social Policy Studies at Columbia Law School. The report, Black Girls Matter, can be found on the Policy Forum's website. That's AAPF.org. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin, Kimberly Crenshaw.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.